inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. If you're tuning in for the first time, or if you were listening to the Forward Thinking Show and you just haven't turned your computer yet, welcome, and I hope you'll stay around, and I hope you'll hear something useful or interesting or funny or something that you wanted to hear, or maybe even needed to hear. Wouldn't that be terrific? I like to say at the beginning of the show what this show is more or less about. I talk a lot about change and why people can't change when they want to. I use as a basis for that conversation a book I wrote called When You Can, You Will. It's all about this, all about why people can't change when they want to, what obstacles get in the way, and how you can figure out what's stopping you from doing what you want to do and what you might be able to do about that. I tell stories from my private practice as a psychotherapist. Not a surprise to anybody listening that somebody who would be this interested in change would be a psychotherapist. I also tell stories from my own life, and I tell the stories that people email me, and stories from my friends. I just tell stories. I like stories very much. So I'm recording this show. I record all the shows. They're all pre-recorded. That's why you have to email me and you can't call me. But you can email me, and if you wanted to email me, you could do that at Lynn Bernfield, that's one word, LynnEBernfield, at gmail.com. So today I'm recording this show from Los Angeles. Usually I record it from my home in Sarasota, Florida. Sarasota, Florida, a spectacular, wonderful, terrific place that I have been fortunate enough to live in for, oh my goodness, 13 or 14 years now. Before I lived in Sarasota, I lived in Los Angeles, and my whole family is still here. What is left of my whole family is still here. My mom and dad both died over the last couple of years. So over the last, 10 years maybe, I was running back and forth from Florida to Los Angeles. I have a sister and brother who live in Los Angeles, and they were mostly taking care of my parents, but I'm the oldest child in my family. And even if I weren't, I would want both to have helped my sister and brother with that job and also to see as much of my parents as I could. So my dad died 3 years ago and my mother died a year ago. I don't come to Los Angeles nearly as much as I did when one of them was still alive, but I do still come. My private practice is entirely on the telephone now, and most of my clients are in Los Angeles. So when I am in LA, anybody who wants to come in and see me live can, and lots of people do. In fact, some people who I don't talk to on an ongoing basis will come in to see me when I'm in Los Angeles. So I'm here for a very long time because I'm also presenting at a convention, and that's exciting for me. This is the first convention I have ever presented at. So the next show I'll let you know how that goes. My sister and I, well, actually all my whole family pretty much was born in March and April. And so it was just my birthday. It was just my sister's birthday. My brother's birthday is coming up. But my sister and I went to Palm Springs to celebrate our birthdays together. We went to a hotel, which I found out now is a hangout for a lot of Russian emigres. I didn't know that. Lots of, it wasn't Palm Springs. It was Desert Hot Springs. And there were these wonderful mineral hot spring pools, which apparently come out of the earth so hot that they have to be cooled down. And it was a spa. I love spas. I'm a hedonist at heart. And so we got the wraps and we got the facials and hung out at the pools. This is my favorite thing to do. I don't get to do it nearly as much as I'd like. And then we went, there was a Pacific Life Masters tournament in Palm Springs. And we got to go one day. Anyway, we didn't, I love tennis, although I don't play very much anymore. I love it, and I love to watch it. And we didn't know when we bought the tickets who would be playing, but we got to see Rafael Nadal, unfortunately. I wanted him to win, but he lost to Djokovic. And then we got to watch Marty Fish, who I'd never heard of, play Roger Federer. If any of you follow tennis, then you know that Roger Federer is the Roger Federer is unbeatable. So Marty Fish, that's spelled M-A-R-D-Y, turns out he's from Tampa. So I got very excited because, you know, Tampa's like an hour away from me in Sarasota. And Marty Fish beat Roger Federer in two straight games. I don't think Roger took three or four games from the entire time. It was amazing to watch, just amazing. And it was amazing also to watch the stadium. Because here is this a complete unknown, really. I mean, I know that he was a college player, and he actually, with, oh Lord, I forgot her name, that's so sad. He won the doubles, mixed doubles. But I had never heard of him, and neither had lots of people in the stands. And you could feel the growing amazement and then excitement over the possibility that this kid might actually pull this off. We all expected Roger Federer to come back. And because I've seen him do that. I've seen him be down, you know, by an impossible number of games and then come back and run right over whoever he was playing, but he didn't. So, you know, it was a combination of him playing really bad tennis and Marty Fish playing just unbelievable textbook tennis. Textbook? Really, Lynn? I think that's textbook. Textbook tennis. Just gorgeous. It's very, very exciting. And although my sister bought these tickets and she had no idea where they were in the stadium, we were fortunate enough to be sitting on the west side, so it was late in the afternoon, and the sun was behind us, streaming at the poor people sitting on the other side of the stadium. It's Palm Springs. I don't know if you know, but it's boiling there. But we weren't. We were sitting in the shade. So, here I am in Los Angeles. When I come to Los Angeles, I live at my sister's house, and I don't know, maybe you heard her dog barking in the background. This is a dog my sister rescued, who looks like Lady of Lady and the Tramp. She's beautiful and sweet. And, you know, if you love dogs or have had dogs, everybody thinks their dog is the best dog. I know my dogs were the best dogs. I had big dogs. I had Akitas. I'll talk about them another time. But this little thing, she's really spectacular. And it's a pleasure to come and spend time with her. But a couple of blocks away from my sister is this wonderful gym. And I always sign up for $49. I can buy a week of the gym. They've got an Olympic swimming pool and sauna and steam and jacuzzi and all the equipment and exercise classes and yoga. And I spend my time doing that and working, seeing my clients, and also seeing my friends, because I still have lots of friends here. And if you were listening at the very beginning of the show, the song that opens the show and the song that closes the show come from my CD, and I recorded that in Los Angeles with the help of my friends. So that was another thing I used to do when I would come. It took 4.5 years to make that CD because I wasn't always here, and my producer and the musicians and the studio and I all had to be available to do the recording, and so it took a very long time to do. But I'm very, very proud of it, and it's not only that I'm proud of it, it took me a very, very long time to do that in my life. On this CD, there's a bonus track. If you've been listening, I played it. It's me at 18 months old recording Zippity-Doo-Dah for my mother to send to my father overseas. So I made my first recording at 18 months old, but I was 60 before I made the next one, this CD. So again, it took me a long, long time, and I suppose what I want to say about that is don't give up, because you never, never know. The thing you want, the thing you've been trying to do, the thing you've been trying to be, it might really just be around the corner. Well, I'm still in L.A., and yesterday I presented at a convention at my old graduate school. It's the Phillips Graduate Institute in Sherman Oaks, California. And the room was filled with graduate students. It was really interesting for me to see them again. I haven't been back to the school. I graduated in 1980, I think. So I haven't seen a bunch of graduate students since then. And, you know, they're adorable and they're eager. And I presented on the subject of resistance, what it is and what you can do about it from the perspective of being a therapist. This is very close to my heart because I think that people tend to label any kind of difficulty that a person has changing as resistance. And when you label it as resistance, you essentially blame the person who's stuck. And of course, the entire premise of my book, When You Can, You Will, is that when someone cannot do something they want to do, when they want to stop doing something they're doing or start doing something that they have always wanted to do or believe would be better for them and they can't do it, it's because there's an obstacle in their path, some really good reason that they can't do this thing. There's a chapter in the book called The Price and the Payoff, and I think that's pretty much always the truth. that when we want to make a change, we're looking at the way our life will be enhanced, the way it will be better, the benefits that we're going to get from that change we want to make. But there is almost inevitably a cost, a price. And we're never looking at the price. But cleverly, yes, ingeniously, our unconscious is looking at the price. Our unconscious has its eyes on the price. And it's getting in our way if the price is too high. Well, we don't really see that because we're such a goal-oriented society. It's all about just doing it. So we're only looking at the what we want to do, and when we can't do that, we're not looking at the why we can't do it. This is a problem if a therapist is doing that. If a therapist is labeling a client as resistant, then the therapist is compounding what that client is almost certainly doing themselves. And that is, the client is almost certainly, like the rest of us, labeling themselves. Oh my God, I'm self-sabotaging. I'm self-destructive. I'm just lazy. I hear that a lot. I hear lazy a lot from clients. People who are working their asses off, but still labeling themselves lazy because this thing that they want to do, they can't make themselves do. So this litany of criticism that we pile on ourselves when we can't do what we want to do, and then if the therapist also feels that, then this is a terrible burden to put on the client. And as I explained to the graduate students, the therapists, all of us really, are at the mercy of the culture we live in. And we live in the Nike culture. You know, you just do it. You want to enough, you try hard enough, and you can do anything you want, which is blatantly untrue as far as I'm concerned. But therapists have an additional burden to carry, and that is that their self-esteem may be on the line. They want to help. They want to fix it. That's why they went into this career, so that they could do good. So if a client comes and the client can't do whatever it is they've decided they need to do, then the therapist's self-esteem may get in the way. Their need to be successful for this client. And that might contribute to their seeing the client as, quote, resistant. But this won't do anybody any good. This will actually make it harder for the therapist to help the client and harder for the client to change. And so, like I explained to these graduate students, what we all want to do is heighten our self-esteem and lower our anxiety. When self-esteem is heightened and anxiety is lowered, everything is easier. And some things will just take care of themselves. Some things won't. Some things, as I've been trying to talk about over the last few weeks and will continue to talk about, require work, psychological work. But there are things that will just fix themselves if we can feel better. Better in general and better about ourselves. And it's kind of like the Hippocratic Oath, you know, do no harm. Do good. So, if you've been listening to me and there is something you want to do in your life and you haven't been able to do it, you want to go back to graduate school, you want to quit school, you want to change your job, you want to stop smoking, you want to leave your spouse, you want to decide to marry the guy or the girl you've been with, you want to write a letter that's really difficult, you want to tell your friend he or she hurt your feelings. You know, it doesn't matter what the thing is, but whatever it is, you're struggling, you can't make yourself do it or stop doing it. Don't label yourself. You are not resistant or lazy or crazy or sabotaging or self-destructive. There's a price to pay for this move, for this change, for this thing. And until you figure out what the price is, and then when you know what the price is, you are able to decide if it's worth paying. So until you can do that,
give yourself a break and do those things which lower your anxiety and heighten your self-esteem. You know, that means do those things which you do well, or which you really enjoy doing, those things that make you feel good, strong, comfortable, competent, happy, and those things that make you feel calm, tranquil, peaceful, serene. Take a bubble bath, walk on the beach, have tea, talk to a friend, read, listen to music, play with a puppy. The things that work for us are person-specific. There is no one-size-fits-all thing that's going to work for everybody. So if you don't already know what are the things that make you feel happy and safe, what are the things that heighten your self-esteem and lower your anxiety, that would be the first place to start, to do a little research project on yourself, pay attention, and find out what those things are so that you can do those things. And when you really feel good about yourself, then you might be able to discover the price that your unconscious thinks you might have to pay for the change you are currently unable to make.
I did a series of exercises with these graduate students. All of them come out of the book and out of the workbook. And they are designed to help whoever's doing them figure out what's the obstacle that gets between them and the change they want to make. And there was one young woman in the room who figured out that the change she needs to make and the thing that she's stuck at is crying. She could feel that there are many, many, many tears to be shed, but she's afraid to cry them. And she said she was afraid to cry them because she thought if she started to cry, she might never stop. She would cry for days and days and days. And she's a new mother, and she was afraid that she would be a bad parent, a bad mommy to her son because she would be so lost in her own pain. And I asked her where she thought she learned that sadness had to be contained and that if you cried, you would be lost forever in your pain and sadness. And she looked blankly at me for a minute, and then she said, "Oh, right." And of course, she was thinking about her mother, who was deeply depressed. And what I said to her was, we can't work on that right now, but that work has to do with modeling. And that's where I am in the process on these shows. I've gotten up to modeling, and I couldn't quite get to it last week because I got carried away with all kinds of other stuff. But I will get to talk about modeling soon in this show. And I did point out to her that she would be a better mommy if she was able to experience and let go of her pain. Because if she can't tolerate her own pain and sadness, she won't be able to tolerate her son's. And she said, oh yes, this has been true already. I'm annoyed at him when he cries. If you can't allow your own sadness, if you can't accept your own sadness, then you can't accept the sadness of others. And of course, for a therapist, this would just be dreadful, because she would then not be able to accept the sadness of her clients, making it impossible for them to accept their own. And in her case, and in a lot of cases, this goes right back to what we learned from our parent, as in modeling. So now I'm going to talk about the significance of modeling.
One of the most powerful tools that families have to influence children is the natural tendency of children to model or copy their parents. Combined with the messages about who your parents wanted you to be are the lessons you learned from observing who they were. If your parents were happy with themselves and with each other, you probably modeled yourself after the parent of the same sex. Generally speaking, this is the best option. When you identify with your same-sex parent, you validate all the things you are. If you're a woman and you want to be just like mommy, then your womanness, which is actually just like mommy, is confirmed. While identifying with the same-sex parent is the most positive choice you can make, it can have negative consequences. Children believe that when they model a parent, they have to take on the whole package. They don't realize that they can take on some qualities and leave others. And this misunderstanding can cause them to adopt qualities that they don't actually want. Later, when they want to jettison some of these traits, they may not realize that it's their identification with the parent that's stopping them. Laura, for example, modeled herself after her mother, Clara. Clara was a wise and gentle woman who Laura loved very much. Clara's early life had been spent in poverty. Consequently, she was cautious and often frightened. Laura, whose life had always been safe and filled with abundance, nevertheless often felt afraid and unexplainedly hoarded things she could well afford to replace. When you want to give up a characteristic you share with a loved parent, it can feel like a betrayal. People who can't stop smoking often have a same-sex parent who's also addicted to cigarettes. While they rarely recognize it, it's their identification with the parent that keeps them from quitting. Diane hadn't realized that being a smoker was a way she had of siding with her mother. Diane's mother had a younger sister named April, who didn't smoke. April had always been considered the good one in the family, and Diane's mother was really jealous of her younger sister. When Diane thought about stopping smoking, it was as if she too, like the rest of the family, would be siding with Aunt April. Diane saw her rejection of smoking as a rejection of her mother. Most of us are consciously or unconsciously reluctant to outdo our parents, especially a same-sex parent, if we've identified with them. You may dislike them today and deny that they have any influence over you, but there was a time when your parents were the complete focus of your life. You wanted to please them, be like them, and keep them happy at all costs. It was then that you vowed not to distress or upset these giants on whom your life depended, a vow you are still honoring today. So that doing better than your parents in any way can feel like an indictment of them. After all, if you're happily married, successful in business, have lots of friends, or remain sober, why couldn't they? To see if you've identified with your same-sex parent, look at the family pie. If all or many of the qualities you've written in your pie piece are also in the pie piece of your same-sex parent, you've modeled yourself on that parent. And if the change you want to make today means that you have to give up a quality that you share with that parent, you may be stopped from making this change by your reluctance to betray the parent who has not yet been able to make that change. Even if you strongly modeled a parent, you can still make a change for yourself that your parent has never been able to make. The first step toward making that change is to recognize that one of the things that's stopping you is that you are a loving child trying to protect a cherished parent. I'm going to stop talking about modeling here because I want to play an interview that I did with a woman named Michelle Brouwerman. As you'll hear at the beginning of the interview, I've decided to do a series of interviews labeled Anatomy of an Artist, What It Takes to Be an Artist in Our Culture, something that's very close to my heart. And I've chosen as the first person to interview Michelle. Michelle is the quintessential artist. If it has anything to do with music at all, Michelle can do it. She can compose it. She can write lyrics for it. She can arrange it. She can produce it. She can write in any style. She produced my CD and hers, from which I'm going to play a cut before the interview, and hopefully there will be time after the interview. Hopefully there will also be time for me to recap a little of the modeling stuff, but if not, I will pick that up next week. And I will actually pick up this interview as well because it just isn't enough time to do the whole interview in this show. So right now I'm going to play a song from Michelle's CD, which is called Fools and Little Children. The cut's called Aurora. It's the first one on the CD. And if you're interested in Michelle's CD and why you wouldn't be, I cannot imagine, it's gorgeous. You can contact me at lynnburnfield@gmail.com, and I will get one to you. And next week I will pick up this interview and continue to talk about modeling and play some more from Michelle's CD. But right now, so that I can leave enough time to do what I want to do in this show, I'm going to stop talking and play Aurora.
I lay in a dream for 100 years while the rest of the world rode past. Safe behind my wall of thorns, a princess under glass. Until I felt a trembling, sweet honey on my lips, fluttering me open. Waking by the wonder of a kiss. Are you the one they promised would come for me one day? Sweep me up behind you and carry me. Are you the fabled perfect prince, the future they foretold? Oh, lady, no, he backed away. I would not be so bold.
Okay, so I'm sitting here with my very, very, very dearest friend, Michelle Brauerman.
Who's rattling papers,
right?
Because I take notes on everything.
You're going to take notes on the interview?
I don't know. I always write things down.
Okay, good. All right, good.
It's my coping mechanism.
So, and I told Michelle that I want to do a series of interviews on the anatomy of the artist, what it takes to be an artist, to try and make a living as an artist in our culture. And I wanted to talk to her about it because I can't think of anybody who has done so much and struggled so much and keeps doing it over and over again in every conceivable area of her life. So I'm going to open it. I don't have an agenda for this interview. I don't have questions. But maybe we could start with you talking about just giving us a sort of overview of your career, how it started, what you thought you wanted to do, some of the things that you did, all of them if you can remember.
Okay. I started off as a child, writing songs and singing and playing the piano.
Child being?
Oh, I was playing and singing by the time I was 3 and making up songs by the time I was 5.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was just there. It was just a part of me. I remember going to National Music Camp in Interlochen, Michigan, which was extraordinary. And when I was 11, and, you know, supposedly in, like, junior division, but taking, like, upper division composition classes there and writing little tunes that I look back on with, like, kind of embarrassment because they were childish, but I was a child. And by the time I was 13, I was, like, writing. I found my first songwriting partner. I could write music, but not lyrics. And there was a girl in my high school named Iris Ratner, and I accosted her in the girls' locker room and said, "You're Iris Ratner." And she said, "Yes," fearfully. And I said, "You write lyrics?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "I write music." She was 3 years older than me. We started writing songs together. Mm-hmm. And she's Iris Rayner Dart, who wrote Beaches, the novel, and many other very famous novels, and wrote for television. She's done very well. She's my first songwriting partner.
Wow.
And then I went to Northwestern University, and I have a degree in music composition from Northwestern, which was a kind of an odd thing. I was the only female composition major in that undergraduate school, and that undergraduate department was not even a tenth of what I expected and hoped it would be, which is sad. I learned a lot. I learned mostly in theory and analysis and other areas, but the composition department was dreadful.
Why?
There were only 2 teachers there. The first that I had, sophomore year, I remember him saying to me at one point early on in the year, "My dear, this is the 21st century. We don't write melodies anymore."
You're kidding.
No, and melodies is what I do best. And then the guy who was the head of the department the next year was just, I just don't feel that he ever taught anything. I don't remember either of them really teaching me anything about the architecture of music, the structure of music, how just a piece was assembled, let alone how to give it depth or beauty or meaning or unity or anything, you know? I mean, they were just, I just remember them as people who taught nothing to me.
Wow.
Which is sad.
Yeah.
I graduated in 3 years instead of 4. That was good. I got out of there. And then I spent a couple of years in Chicago playing in bars, playing first like in piano bars and then in jazz clubs with trios and quartets and learning how to play with a group and playing what we now call, we currently call the Great American Songbook. But I wasn't writing anything. I came out of that school just broken. And I was also, but I also went back and did graduate studies there. I was just sort of, you know, treading water, I think.
I want to stop you. Did you know what you wanted?
I grew up thinking that I wanted to write music and sing and perform it. But I grew up with this weird sense of what my mission was supposed to be, of what I thought I had to do, which was somehow to be a cross between Stravinsky and Streisand. And that anything less than that, I couldn't justify being on the earth.
Good grief.
That was what I felt was my obligation. So I obviously failed.
No.
No, I could. I'm not Stravinsky and I'm not Streisand. I haven't had either of those careers, so I didn't do it.
So that's so interesting because I know who you are, and who you are is so special. Maybe you won't be able to accept this, but it seems to me that you are more than both of them right now. I mean, Stravinsky didn't sing, and Streisand didn't compose.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I mean, but they both were world famous and have left a huge mark, and I think that was part of what I also felt was that the mission that I was supposed to fulfill. I've left a mark, though. I mean, I think I've written a lot of music that a lot of children have heard, that's for sure.
Oh, tell about that.
Okay, I stumbled into this, but I was asked to write songs for a sequel to the Land Before Time movie, and that was in 1994. So I co-wrote songs for that sequel with Amanda McBroom, and they liked our work on that so much that they asked us to do another and then another and then another one. And up until till now, I think we've written, co-written songs for 15 or 16 animated features for children. Mm-hmm. And I also became the producers of those songs. And they include, I think it's like 9 or 10 sequels to Land Before Time, American Tale 4, Hercules and Xena, the animated feature, Chipmunks Meet Frankenstein, one of my proudest moments, and 2 Balto sequels, and Br'er Rabbit. So I've done a lot of music for kids. And right now, oddly enough, Amanda and I are writing a musical, which we're going to be doing a production of at Northwestern University, where mm-hmm. I went to school. And a lot of the students that are in it grew up watching The Land Before Time.
Well, I want to back up to the idea of leaving a mark and how that, not only for you, but for so many of us, is a driving force, and that it seems to exist in tandem with the work that we want to do.
Well, I think it's probably 2 things. I mean, there may be something genuinely about it that has, there may be some real reason that that should be a drive, but I think there's a lot of factors. First of all, we live in a society that emphasizes celebrity so badly. I mean, I've done really good work that I'm proud of. It's been heard a lot. They've sold millions of videos. I don't know if that's what I want on my headstone, but I'm a working composer in a world where that almost doesn't exist, where in the entertainment industry, to a huge extent, there's only 2 ways you can go. You can just struggle and scrape and not survive, or you become phenomenally successful. I live in that area in between. There aren't that many people that I know of that do, although I think there's more than I'm aware of, because you wouldn't necessarily be aware of them.
Mm-hmm.
But there, I'm a working musician. I've made a living, supported myself and my children when I had to.
And,
as a composer and producer. And
also, although it may not be the primary way you want to be remembered, as an accompanist, as a music teacher, as a voice teacher,
musical director.
As a musical director.
And arranger, yeah. And I've come to value that, too. For a long time, I devalued it. I devalued it was because something I did as a child without even trying. It was effortless. And it wasn't an ambition I had. I certainly had no ambitions about being an accompanist. That was like a demeaning situation, oddly enough. And it just had to do with the way I was used as a child, as the accompanist to my parents or my sisters or anyone else who wanted to sing. It was, it felt demeaning because I didn't feel that it was a choice. And so I carried that for a long, long, long time. I don't carry that so much anymore. I have realized that I love accompanying a great singer. And that I, you know, it's like putting my hands under somebody, and it's actually a wonderful thing to be able to do. I like it, and I do it really well, and I thoroughly enjoy it. And then I even would go so far as to say that part of me feels a lot safer doing that than I do if I'm like in front singing and playing.
Well, you know, that brings up the issue of the dichotomy for all people who try and make their living in the creative arts. You know, if you're, I worked with a lot of people who wanted to be writers, wanted to be artists, fine artists, who wound up working in advertising
mm-hmm.
because that was the only place that would pay for those skills. It isn't what they wanted to do.
Right.
Because they fell in love with words or they fell in love with pictures, but this was the only place in our culture that allowed them to make a living.
Right. Well, I mean, you have to do something. The world is such that we have to do something, you know, to pay our way. Unless somebody else pays for us, which I would have found unacceptable, even if I had been offered it, I think. In fact, I think, looking back, I did my best to steer clear of any situation where that might have been at all possible. So, along with steering clear of probably a lot of people who might have helped me in other ways, I just did a really good job of avoiding that.
Well, and again, you know, I don't think that's so uncommon. The idea so many artists, I think, get the idea that we pretty much have to do it ourselves, because there's so little support, really, in this culture for artists. You either are, as you say, a celebrity, and then everybody wants a piece of you, or they want to know what you do for a living, you know, what your gig is, what your job is, because this stuff isn't serious somehow.
Right. And it's funny, too, Lynn. When I'm putting this in quotes, working at what I do, it's not work. It's not work. They talk about playing an instrument, and playing is the operative word. When I'm working on a project creatively, it's like playing dress-up when I was a child. It's using my imagination. It's playing these great games of what if. We were at Northwestern a few weeks ago for a casting, weekend of casting and meetings, and the costumer came in with the designs for our show. Oh, my God, you should have seen. So gorgeous, and I started to cry. I mean, the idea that this thing that we're making with our imaginations is going to be actually a real thing on a stage with people in costumes on a set and movement, and it's thrilling. It's thrilling. I'm very excited.
Yeah, it's we don't live in a culture that has value for what you just described. And I think that is all really that's of value.
I think we're living in an Orwellian culture. If you go back and read Brave New World, read the first four chapters, there's a sequence in there that It's so powerful, where these babies who are all raised, in petri dishes and incubators, and now they're like little infants who are crawling, and they're showing a visitor around the incubation center, and they put all the babies in this big, huge room, like a big gymnasium with a shiny, beautiful wood floor. All the babies are on this shiny floor, all in a line, and at the far end of the room, people come in and they bring red roses, and they set them in a line at the other end of the room. And all the babies get very excited, and they immediately start crawling across the floor to get to the red roses. Third of the way across the floor, an electrical shock goes off and shocks all the babies. They are being conditioned to not respond to nature or to beauty.
Or to beauty, that's true.
Because beauty and nature are not necessarily packageable and saleable commodities, and the economy in that world is based on everything being packaged and sold. And if people learn to be content with beauty or relationships or art or process, there's not money to be made in that.
This reminds me of two things. Shirley MacLaine's trip to China, I believe I'm correct in saying she took the very first delegation of women to China after it was opened up.
Mm-hmm.
And they went to an art factory where people were turning out art, and they were turning out the same thing over and over again. And she apparently said to the person who was running it, so what happens if you have Michelangelo here? What do you do with him? And the guy said, oh, well, we re-educate him. And it's that same thing, it's not useful, we don't value it.
Right.
And in this culture, it's not quite that bad, but we only value it if it makes a lot of money. So the dilemma for a person who comes into life as early as you did, in love with music, or drawing, or dance, or whatever it is that you find, just captures you, and when you're doing it, time passes without you knowing it, and you're immersed, and it is your life. It's what you know. So for people like you and me, there is not really a path.
If you're just tuning in, this is The Lynn Show, and you've been listening to much of an interview with Michelle Brauerman, not all of. It may have seemed a little abrupt at the end, but we couldn't do all of it in this show, and so I'm saving some, then I'll play it in the next show. If you were listening before the interview, I played a song from Michelle's CD called Fools and Little Children, a song that she wrote called Aurora. And I'm going to play another one from that CD. This is a a song that she wrote with Amanda McBroom. If you were listening to the interview, you heard her mention that she sometimes writes with Amanda. The song is called Old Love, and it's wonderful, as is everything on this CD. So I'm going to play Old Love, and then I'm going to do a wrap-up of what I was talking about at the beginning of the show, modeling, and how modeling influences our ability to change.
Late last November, the telephone rang. She was sweeping the kitchen floor. A voice from the past said, "Are you Anna Jean? Did you live in Greenville in 1924? Do you remember the first boy you kissed out beside the old gym?" She said, "You always remember your very first beau." And he said, "Well, you're talking to him." It was old love, so long ago, and yet through the time and the tears and the passage of years, some things a heart won't forget. Skipped a beat when he said, "Can we meet? There's something you might like to see. It's a picture in glass of a second grade class. I'm sitting there smiling with you next to me." She turned her eyes to the old grand piano where the picture stood in its place. It was old, it was worn, it was faded and torn, but she knew the smile on that face. It was old love, so long ago, and yet through the time and the tears and the passage of years, some things a heart won't forget. They talked until dark, till the moon was aglow in the trees. Then he took her hand and got down on his knees. "I've got two questions to ask, if you please. Would you consider becoming my wife? We both know I'm not a young pup." When she said yes, "Now, what's the next question?" He said, "Would you help me get up?" It was old love, so long ago, and yet through the time and the tears and the passage of years, some things a heart won't forget. Oh, some things a heart can't forget.
And that was Old Love, written by Michelle Brauerman and Amanda McBroom, sung, played, arranged, produced by Michelle. You can hear Amanda singing harmonies on the choruses. I am so grateful to be able to call Michelle and Amanda my friends. But Michelle has been a friend of mine for a very long time, and I never get tired of listening to her work, or her play, as she said in the interview. Okay, so a little wrap-up on modeling. When we're kids, we look up at our parents and we see what we believe is really all there is in the world. These people, these giants, these magic beings, They are our world. We want, as I said earlier in the show, to please them, to make them happy, to be like them. But at the most, we want them to be happy. We want them to be comfortable, because we know that our comfort, our safety, our lives depend on them. So we do whatever it is we need to do to make them happy. But we also think that they are what is, and we model. You've heard the thing about baby ducks. Oh, gosh, what do they call that? They don't call it patterning. Somebody write to me and tell me what they call imprinting. It's imprinting, right? That the baby duck looks at the mommy and then does whatever the mommy does. And they've done research, you know, if they take the mommy away and they put a person there, then the baby duck follows the person and tries to be a person. Well, we human babies are just the same. I was in a parking lot once, and I saw a dad with two little boys on the back of his motorcycle. He got off his motorcycle, he took the two little boys off, and then he walked into the grocery store. And these two little boys walked behind him, identical walks to him. It was very funny and very duck-like. So, as I said earlier, if you like your parent of the same sex, and if your parents seem to like each other and get along, then the chances are good that you will have modeled yourself after your same-sex parent. And that, for the most part, is the healthiest thing to do, because it confirms the things about you which are just like the same-sex parent. I suggested that you could look at your family pie and see whether you wrote the qualities that you put in your pie piece. Many of them, all of them, most of them are also in the pie piece of your same-sex parent, because if they appear there, then the chances are really good that you identified with your same-sex parent. It occurred to me after I recorded that piece that those of you who were not listening to the show about the family pie have no idea what I'm talking about. So let me tell you that you can download the podcast for the show, which describes the exercise of the family pie. There are two, actually. And you can get that from my website. My website is thelinshow.com. You can download that podcast and the ones for all of the rest of the shows. You can also buy the book from which all of this information is coming, or the workbook, which is a standalone piece and has all of the exercises in it, or the audiobook, where obviously I'm reading it. Or you can connect to CD Baby and get a copy of my CD, songs from which you have heard at the beginning and will hear at the end. I'm rushing because I'm running out of time. Anyway, why don't I just stop here and say that this has been The Lynn Show. Oh, no, I can't stop without thanking Josh Hackney, my miraculous IT guy, without whom none of this would be possible. And you can get a hold of Josh also by contacting me at lynnburnfield@gmail.com. This has been The Lynn Show. I'll be back next Tuesday at 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, and I sure hope you will be here too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that.